This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu.
You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden.
And I'm Kevin McClenathan, and I am floating picturesquely above my podcasting setup right now, Wade, suspended by wires perhaps, but hopefully you can't tell.
Kevin, I just got one question for you. Are you ready to get down to business?
I think I am. I have a feeling this episode is going to make a man out of me.
Listeners, first up, today we're tackling the new Disney live-action adaptation, Nikki Caro's Mulan.
We're also going to be continuing our Summer of Darkness marathon. Last week we did the neo-noir Chinatown, so we're moving on to maybe a neo-neo-noir. With this week's episode, we're going to be reviewing Rian Johnson's high school set noir, Brick.
Kevin, I do have to say, I was homeschooled, and this film is, from my experience, very accurate.
I can't say that I ever got into any parking lot brawls when I was in high school, but that's probably because I wasn't cool enough.
All that's coming up on this episode, episode 263 of Seeing and Believing.
Do you know why the Phoenix sits on the right hand of the Emperor? She is his guardian, his protector. That she's both beautiful and strong. Your job is to bring honor to the family. Do you think you can do that?
Listeners, that is a clip from Disney's Mulan. We're going to be talking about that film in a bit. Kevin, I know people aren't going to the theaters much these days. I haven't gone very much at all this summer. And yet, it was still hard to pay $30 to see Mulan, but we did it for our listeners. We did it for them.
That's right. We do want to make sure that we are bringing at least as cutting edge content as we can, given the limitations of the current situation. But I feel your pain on that Mulan purchase. Kind of literally, I could feel the syringe jabbing into my arm and sucking away my lifeblood, just like my bank account was being tapped in that moment.
Well, I hope our listeners, they'll appreciate the sacrifice. Hopefully, you didn't spend the whole movie counting how much each minute cost you, saying, okay, you know, 90 minutes, $30, doing all that. I guess it was 2 hours, so you get more bang for your buck. But I hope our listeners will appreciate that, and I'm glad to talk about it with you. Listeners, we're going to hop into our review of Mulan later on. We're going to be talking about Rian Johnson's Brick, a film that you can rent not for $30, but for $3. And I'm going to say right now, Kevin, I think it's worth it.
I mean, I'm not going to make any secret about the fact I really like Brick, and I wholeheartedly endorse that sentiment.
Yeah. So, directed by Nikki Caro, Mulan is the live-action remake or adaptation, however you want to say it, of Disney's 1998 animated, to some, classic. Here's the film's official synopsis: to save her ailing father from serving in the Imperial Army, a fearless young woman, played by Yifeng Liu, disguises herself as a man to battle northern invaders in China. Kevin, I'll admit, this was probably the first Disney live-action remake I've been relatively interested in seeing for some time. We've gone through some pretty bad ones. I've watched the animated version many times over the years, and I liked it. I still watch it every once in a while. I think it's a fine film. To get us started, I want to ask you, do you have any history with the 1998 version? And if so, how do you think this new film works as an adaptation of that previous release?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have a history with the original, except insofar as I saw the original Once Upon a Time. And, you know, I liked it okay. Just about, like, just about everybody, the training montage song is really great. And, you know, just thinking about it makes me want to kind of, like, hum a few bars and get stuck in my head all over again. I would say that Mulan overall might be kind of middle of the pack Disney as far as their animated offerings go. I thought it was fine, didn't really blow me away. With this remake, so I guess going into this remake, I didn't really feel any particular emotional attachment to the original. There wasn't a whole lot of stuff that I was really hoping would be included or that would be smoothed over in some way. I was kind of indifferent as to those concerns as far as it goes. I think the issue with this film, and I guess I'm tipping my hand right away that I'm not crazy about it, is that I don't think that I appreciate that Disney and Nicky Caro are kind of maybe trying to do something slightly more adventurous than what we saw with the Lion King remake, which was just pretty much, you know, almost a shot, not really a shot for shot remake, but basically they just took the original animated version and they changed the visuals, but didn't really do anything else to really improve upon it or even make it seem more essential. So I do appreciate that Caro's film really doesn't go that route. There's a lot that's different about this film. It does seem to really make an effort to situate itself as kind of a Wuxia war epic in the vein of, you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or Red Cliff, or one of those films. I think the problem is, though, that it doesn't really go far enough in doing that, and it kind of ends up feeling just sort of dour, I guess might be the way I would describe this film. There's not really, there's no spark to this that you would find even in the animated original film. And I guess I found myself wishing that this had been less of an adaptation or a remake of Disney's Mulan, but been more of an attempt to just tell the legend of Mulan just straight up and shed some of the baggage that the anime original imposes upon this material. I think by having this sort of hybrid approach where they're trying to hit some of the same story beats as the animated original while also making it into this more Wuxia epic film, it kind of ends up getting the worst of both worlds. I don't know. It doesn't seem very essential to me, even though it may not sink to the depths of something like the Lion King remake. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I didn't like the Lion King remake, as our listeners probably remember. And it felt like a money grab. And I realize that there are a lot of people who work on these films and maybe they don't approach it that way, but that's at least, you know, what it did feel like. I do like some of the changes here. And the production team, the screenwriters, and there's a lot of them, which is kind of strange because it doesn't feel like this story is too different from the animated features. But they did choose to strip some of the songs, all of the songs. And of course, Eddie Murphy's character is gone. He plays one of the ancestral guardians in the animated film, and so he's not there. So it is a little bit different, but you used the word dour, and there are a couple of scenes that I felt like were exciting, thrilling, maybe funny or charming, but overall, the film was fine for me. Now, it probably ranks as the fourth best Disney live action adaptation that we've seen in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. That's not saying very much. I do like Jungle Book and Pete's Dragon and Cinderella. This one's just fine. It doesn't make a ton of errors, but it doesn't do a lot to warrant its existence. And as we talk about that, hopefully we'll kind of detail this a little bit more, but it didn't take enough risk, as you were saying. It kind of wanted the best of both worlds, and as a result, kind of came away with nothing. So, yeah, kind of disappointed because I was excited about this film to see what it could do and to see if Disney could stretch its wings, and sadly, they didn't do that.
Well, it kind of seems like Caro and her creative team didn't really quite know what makes a Wuxia picture kind of work. You know, all of the supernatural elements or the heightened reality elements might be a better word for it. You know, the famous scene from Crouching Tiger where we have these two swordsmen and they're fighting in a bamboo forest and they're kind of like running along stalks of bamboo and it's physically impossible, but it's beautiful. And there's some storytelling and character development that is sort of woven into these action sequences that make them more than just a cool fight scene. And I think that in Mulan, it kind of, it feels like it appropriates some of the tropes of these other films, but it still kind of uses them as part of an overarching, very, very Western action movie understanding of how and why action functions in a movie. It ends up feeling a little bit like a, you know, by trying to have those two approaches combined into one, it feels a little bit like kind of a boring war movie with weird physics. There's just not a whole lot of the whiz-bang action because Caro's going for a little bit more artistry with her approach, but that artistry gets muted by the fact that we're kind of just seeing pretty standard action movie heroics here. And not that that's bad, but just it seems like she doesn't really understand why she's having characters run on walls and do all of these other things, other than that those sorts of things have been in other movies, and so they need to be in this movie. And I think that approach maybe speaks to a larger problem with the movie as a whole, which is that it just seems like they're trying to hit certain beats. They're trying to create something that ticks off boxes rather than functions on its whole as a work of as a satisfying work of art. And that extends maybe to the storytelling as well.
Yeah. No, some of those action sequences. And in this film, they talk about the chi and how she operates within the chi and she can do things that are physically impossible. There is this line between, oh, wow, that's fantastic. And I use fantastic literally. And, oh, that's cartoonish. And, oh, that's maybe you could say cheesy. There were a couple of sequences where you kind of laugh and you're not supposed to laugh. So it goes with kind of the meaning behind some of those moves as well as the techniques behind them to be able to make them work. There are a couple of shots that I think were pretty good. There's some tilts. There are some shots where the camera is either upside down or moves upside down, kind of rotates on a 90-degree angle at other times. There's some blur shots, some characters kind of coming through the desert. So there is skill involved in the film. It's just not always employed correctly, and it didn't really make these action sequences pop. I kind of got bored with a lot of them, and it happens more and more with big blockbusters. It shouldn't happen, but it definitely happened here. I did want to talk too about some of the themes in the film. And originally, with the animated cartoon, the animated film, it wasn't received all too well in China because it was a largely Western story about individualism, and there are benefits to that. But there was this kind of clash with the cultures in that film. And in this movie, I feel like there was this move or this shift to kind of correct that. So it is a very individualistic tale, and that Mulan, her character, she has to grow as a person, be herself, and be herself in a society that does not view women in the way that some sections of our society do. And so she has to overcome that. And the film talks about her overcoming that, not just for herself, but also the sacrifice that's there for her and her family and her community. And there's talk, too, of shaming her village. And one of the, I think, best pieces of production design in this movie is the village that she lives in, and they are almost in this Colosseum-like building. It's this circular structure, I should say. Of course, there's no roof on it, and they all kind of live there, and they live their lives out in the open of each other. And I thought that was a great representation of how these individuals are connected to a particular group of people, and that what they do has consequences, honor or shame in that culture. But I don't think the film really dug into that. It seemed like, okay, yeah, do it for the people around you. Do it for your family. But there's nothing there to emphasize that. And I'm reminded, Kevin, of the Farewell. It made my top 10 list last year, and it deals with similar themes. And of course, the main character of Awkwafina, she has grown up in the States, and so she has a particular perspective, and she meets her family in China. They have a particular perspective, and yet we see the good and maybe even the negatives of both, and how they each have something to teach each other. We don't get that type of nuance here, and so I think that's a little bit disappointing too.
Yeah, I mean, not being Chinese, I don't know if, like, I'm wary of trying to comment too specifically on whether this feels like an authentic representation of a certain cultural outlook on women's roles. But I guess I can comment, though, on the way this movie tries to dramatize some of those aspects. I think by looking at the ways that the film falls short in those areas, to me, that suggests certain things perhaps about the authenticity of its other portrayals that I don't have firsthand experience with. So there's kind of this problem with with latter day Disney, I guess, where a lot of their stories kind of have this very market-tested quality to them, where they sort of decide, okay, we want to make sure that we have a certain representation in our film, or we want to make a more feminist retelling of a Disney princess story in a certain way. And they kind of set out with that in mind. It does feel like that affects the shape of the story, so that they're trying to hit these notes that will appeal to, you know, an audience in 2020 that will satisfy kind of what's in the political and social mainstream. But they do it in a very, very almost cartoonish kids movie way where it doesn't feel true. I think about moments from the Beauty and the Beast remake where, you know, Belle is sitting down with a little girl and she's like showing her a book and kind of teaching her to read. And, you know, some stuffed shirt comes up and goes, "What, teaching a girl to read? Isn't one enough?" And it's very obvious. It feels very much like there's not been a whole lot of attention paid to the way that patriarchy actually manifests itself in a society, and the insidious ways that can work upon the groups that are oppressed by it. In this movie, there's something similar that happens where, you know, at the beginning of the movie, there's this sequence where young Mulan is chasing a chicken around, and it leads her up onto a roof, and it's very dangerous, and she slips off the roof. And she pulls off some acrobatic move in order to make it to the ground safely. And her father breathes a sigh of relief. But everyone else around her is kind of like, gives her this dirty look. Like, how dare she pull off this amazing acrobatic move just to save her life? And that's kind of the bum note that I'm talking about, where it seems like the movie is laying it on so thick and with such kind of almost a caricatured approach to these dynamics that it makes me distrust the authenticity of its cultural representations as well. Is it also giving us this very two-dimensional portrayal of Chinese culture as well and the legends arising out of that culture? And that makes me uneasy, and it doesn't speak well, I guess, of the overall creative vision behind the film.
Yeah. And like you said, I don't want to reach too far because I am unfamiliar with certain cultural norms. So there is this perspective that I definitely bring, or this lack of perspective, maybe is a better way to say it. But even the ideas that they talk about or suggest in the movie, there's not a depth to them. It's just kind of, I guess you could say, lip service for some of these ideas and these bigger themes that connect to the hearts of the characters, that mean something to them. And if it means something to these characters, then it should probably mean something to us, or at least we should get a taste of that. And we don't really get a taste of that. So I definitely think that's a problem. One aspect of the film that I liked, and I thought was a nice change, was the character of that Gong Li plays. Now, she plays this individual, this woman. She's called a witch throughout the film. She has power, and she's been scorned by the world. She's an outcast because she's tried to be who she feels like she needs to be. And as a result, now she wants to hurt other people, and she's attached herself to the main villain in the picture. And I like that. I thought that there was some depth there versus just revenge or a sort of shallow quest for power. But instead, we see how the forces affecting Mulan have affected other people. Now, like you mentioned, they're really not much to cling to. It's all very kind of cliche, but I appreciate them doing that and adding that into the screenplay, which provides some opportunities for some changes and some twists later on in the movie, which I thought were pretty good. So this is not a film that I dislike. I think it's fine. I think it's okay. It certainly could be worse, but there are some things about the film, some aspects that make me wish that the rest of the movie was a little more consistent.
I agree that Gong Li's character is an interesting addition or change from the animated version that most audiences are familiar with, because it seems like that is something that kind of arose organically out of an attempt to tell the story, but just do something a little bit different. And I appreciate it for doing that. I do kind of, her character is odd mostly because it seems like she's sort of the primary villain. And yet we kind of have Jason Scott Lee's Bori Khan, who's kind of the warlord who is leading this assault on China. It's odd that he is still in this movie, not because he's not compelling in his own way. I think Jason Scott Lee gives a very good performance as far as it goes, but it just seems in terms of just the way the screenplay is structured and the story is being told here, it does kind of seem like he's almost ancillary, and that the real interest here is the dichotomy that is set up between Mulan and her view of how her talents intersect with her duties, versus how Gong Li's character Shaneng, how she sees her own place and the best use of her own powers. I think that's an interesting contrast that is set up that isn't paid off to its very fullest, which is too bad because it does have some intriguing notes.
Yeah, yeah, and that's kind of goes back to that word you used, dour. Just a film that sees some sparks for me, but mostly kind of gets lost in the, I guess, mechanics of the story and the script. I'd like to see a little more life in that. Listeners, that is our review of Mulan. It's currently playing on Disney+. If you purchase it. So if you plan to watch it, definitely let us know what you think. You can tweet us at SeeBelievePod, at SeeBelievePod. You can also email us, seeingandbelieving, capc@gmail.com. Kevin, I will say this. We've got a lot of the Disney live-action remakes, and there is one rumored from David Lowry. It's a Peter Pan remake or adaptation, and that has me a little excited. I like many of his movies, and I like Peach Dragon. So maybe that one will make its way to us and turn out well.
Yeah, we'll see. I like Lowry. I liked Pete's Dragon okay. I do kind of wish that my favorite filmmakers and actors would just try to avoid getting sucked into the Disney event horizon as much as mm-hmm. possible. But, you know, you can't have everything, and I'll probably be interested to see what he does with that project.
Hey, a guy's got to eat. A guy's got to make some money and then go back and, and make The Old Man and the Gun Part 2. We'll see. Listeners, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be reviewing Rian Johnson. Speaking of people who hopped on the Disney bandwagon, Rian Johnson's Brick. Don't go anywhere. Listeners, that song is It's That Kinda Night by Alf. We want to take an opportunity and say a big thanks to all of you who support us via our Patreon campaign. It's quick and it's easy to support the podcast, and it's something that we're just thankful for. You can hop on over to patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast. We've got a number of different donation levels, and one of our favorites is the What Can You Buy for $5 level. You know, Kevin, it's been a busy week. Every week I look forward to hearing your answer, especially this week. What can someone buy for $5?
Oh, well, before I say, I have to ask, why especially this week? Is there a special occasion that I'm unaware of?
You know, it's just been kind of a busy week, and pay $30, you got to pay $30 for Mulan. I just need a little pick me up.
That looms large in your consciousness, I can tell.
So what can you buy for $5?
Well, $5. So, I mean, you know, it has been a busy week. And for those of you who are, you know, working on the go and have to have, you know, video conferences with coworkers or, mm-hmm. you know, Zoom meetings, that sort of thing, $5 would get you little finger puppets that you can put right up to your the webcam on your laptop or whatever. And, you know, you can kind of dress it up to look like you so that it looks like you're keeping it professional during your work from home. Even though you're, you know, just wearing your pajamas all day. So
wow.
Seems like a good investment.
Yeah, you just kind of nod your finger every once in a while, let people know that you're there, you're paying attention. You know, I mentioned this, and this it felt like I mentioned this years ago, but it was just a few months ago, that with wearing face masks, my ventriloquist act has become much easier. And you commented on, I posted on Facebook, you commented and said, it's easy too because you can put one on the puppet as a sign of solidarity. And it, man, I'm telling you, my act has gone through the roof with face masks.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear it that your budding ventriloquism career continues to grow apace.
And it gives me some time. I really have to learn how to be a ventriloquist in this period because it won't last forever. One day we'll take off the masks and I will either be seen as authentic or a fraud. And that's a fear of mine.
Well, I hope that when that day comes, you'll have grown far enough in your skills that won't be necessary. That fear will not be borne out.
I'll be ready. I'll be ready. Born for this moment. It'll be a Bill and Ted moment to reference last week's episode. Listeners, hop on over to patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast and support the podcast. We really appreciate it. In just a moment, we'll be back. We're going to hop in to Brick, continue our Summer of Darkness series.
Brendan.
Emily?
I really screwed up.
Screwed up how?
The brick.
What?
I didn't know it was bad, but the pin's on it now. You gotta help me.
Slow down now. This isn't good.
No.
Emily said words I didn't know. Tell me if they catch.
Brick?
No.
Tug?
Tug might be a drink, like milk and vodka.
Pin? You know the kingpin. Dope runner, right?
Big time. What are you gonna do?
She asked for my help. I just wanna know she's okay.
So what's first?
I'm gonna start shaking things up.
We're here in the second segment, and I was trying to think for a while, Wade, of how I could incorporate some good old hard-boiled detective slang into this intro because it figures so prominently in the movie that we're about to review. And I just couldn't really do it. I'm no Raymond Chandler, and I guess at some point a guy just has to admit his limitations, but I just have to get that out there to let everyone know that I did try and I wanted so badly to do it, but I figured it would be better not to even try than to do a terrible job of it.
That goes against our philosophy 263 episodes in, Kevin. So I'm really, wow, a lot of respect over here to just refraining from that.
Yeah, I mean, they say that you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take. But what they don't say about that is with all those shots that you don't take, you also miss 100% of the ridicule you would have had from missing them. So, I feel like it kind of balances out in the end.
Right. Well, and that quote supposes that you would make any shots, right? So,
correct.
Yeah. So it works out. We've had our lumps in the past with impressions, and it's best to just move forward.
Yeah. Move forward. Keep our eyes toward the future, that sort of thing. I am excited to talk about the movie in the second segment. Rian Johnson's Brick, I believe it had its release in 2006, and it was Johnson's first feature film, which is quite impressive when you consider just how fully realized his vision of the noir genre is. This is a film starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Brendan, as the typical noir gumshoe with one small exception. This gumshoe is in high school. All of the people around him are in high school. And even though they all have names like The Pin, Tugger, The Brain, Dode, very noirish names, they all exist in this context that most of us, if not all of us, are at least passingly familiar with, homeschooled or no way.
It's wild to me because you think about Brick, and if someone were to explain it to you, and maybe there are people listening who have not watched the film and they're just like, what a noir mystery set in high school, and the dialogue is what? It just doesn't seem like it would work. And I mean, it's no surprise that Johnson had this screenplay lying around for years and years, and no one wanted to pick it up. But somehow he made it work. I mean, it's just really amazing. It really is.
It really is. And I think part of the reason is that Johnson doesn't do what you might expect with that setup. It sounds like any one of a number of subpar teen movies where the entire movie is tied up in sort of this gimmick where it tries to get by solely on the charm of having high schoolers do things that aren't normally high schoolish, but they're still kind of doing it in the setting that we're all familiar with. In this case, though, Johnson essentially plays the tropes straight. Brendan is trying to solve the mystery of the murder of his ex-girlfriend. He's attempting to gather facts. He's interviewing subjects. He's trying to get to the bottom of essentially this crime network. So that's not cutesy in the way that you might expect a typical teen movie to go. Johnson obviously has a deep reverence for the way noir movies work and a deep understanding of why they work. So to get us started, Wade, maybe we can talk a little bit about that. As we've gone through the series, we've seen different twists on noir tropes, and even though they all share many similarities, they kind of carry their own little spins on those familiar elements. this one does that as well. My question for you is, watching this, how did you find those elements to work in this picture? Do you kind of share my viewpoint that it works really well and that the fact that it plays it straight helps to reveal certain undercurrents in the genre that you hadn't noticed were there before? Or would you take issue with my characterization, and would you say that it kind of is a little bit cutesy for your taste?
No, I love it. It is fascinating. Like you say, this is not a parody of a noir thriller or noir mystery, but instead Johnson, he plays it straight. And I very much appreciate how someone this young and inexperienced can put together a story as realized as this with characters that you actually care about and an individual who can compose images like the ones that we get in Brick. And so if we're talking about the noir subgenre, if we're talking about what it does to sort of maintain its connection to that, I mean, we could look at the unbalanced framing. We could look at the use of natural lighting to create a sense of like realism and a shadowy, dark effect. We really experience the story through the visuals. You could watch this movie with the sound off and really understand the world or even the situation. The camera shots that are high and that are low, just a dynamic of power and also vulnerability. So this is a world where you have characters at different places in society. And that's what I felt like it emphasized extremely well within the noir genre, that you do have this criminal network, but there are people at the top. And there's not only just people at the bottom, but there's people that fill the middle, and the dynamics of these compositions, as well as the story and the dialogue, help to highlight a whole society, this underground group that really kind of runs things behind the scenes, and that in a sense connects to this overall darkness that we've explored in noir films and this sense of fate and inevitability. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to appreciate. This is the second time I watched the film. I liked it a lot the first time. I liked it much more this time. And part of it is because of the series, seeing how it uses some of those elements from previous noir films. It's great. It's fascinating because it almost takes Chinatown and it adds new wrinkles to that neo-noir setting. Just a great film. So I echo your thoughts.
Yeah, the ending of this film does have a very similar vibe to the ending of Chinatown. Just the sense of something being lost and a deep weariness and sadness that kind of comes over the character at the very end. That's definitely the case here. I think watching this film revealed a side of noir that had mostly remained in the background for me, which is the sense of there kind of not being an adult in charge, so to speak. You watch a lot of noirs and it feels as if whether, you know, God or a righteous authority figure or however you might want to put it, is kind of absent from the picture. There we see a lot of men and women sort of out for themselves, and there's not really anything governing the world. The world is sort of this dark place, and we're all just sort of trying to make our way through it. Sort of like how we talked about the themes that were brought forth in Chinatown last week. In this one, Johnson finds a really interesting way of literalizing that, in that this is obviously a high school. These are all teenagers, or all the protagonists are teenagers. So you kind of expect there to be adults around. You know, there will be teachers, there will be parents, there will be coaches, you know, however it might be. You kind of, this is a context where you would expect those authority figures to be present and to be exerting their influence in some way. But for the vast majority of the picture, there are no adults. I think there are two scenes in this film where an adult is even on screen. One of them is the assistant vice principal, I think, who basically has this really fun twist on the angry police chief scene where, you know, the detective comes in and the police chief reads in the riot act and calls him a renegade, and they have this confrontation. So that by itself is just a really amusing scene. But that's one instance where an adult shows up. And the other instance is where this drug kingpin's mother sits them down and like serves them all cereal and orange juice and kind of is very motherly. And that's also kind of a nice undercutting of the hard-bitten nature of these characters. Other than those two scenes, though, the movie is completely absent of adults. There are these chase scenes through the grounds, the campus of this high school that these characters go to, and they're almost eerily deserted. There are no adults. There's nobody stepping in to stop what seems to be this violence and this these abuses that are going on. And to me, that there's something about that that feels quintessentially noir that other noirs couldn't really get at in the same way, because obviously in those movies they're all adults. There's nobody who's just like a clear, obvious, oh yes, this is a logical authority figure for all of these characters. In Brick, the parents, the teachers, the adults, the forces of stability are nowhere to be found. And that too feels very noirish.
Yeah, there's this lawlessness to the entire ordeal. I mean, yeah, it's wonderful. I think there are two shots that reflect the influences of this film, or at least pay some service to them. One is where Brendan is walking across the football field. And for a second, it felt like a shot that you would see in a John Hughes film, maybe the end of The Breakfast Club, where these characters are kind of walking on this football field, and it just highlights high school life. You know, this is where it happens. This is where it all goes down on the football field. But it takes new meaning in Brick. And then there's another scene where Brendan is essentially saying goodbye to his ex-girlfriend. We know at the beginning of the film that she has died because we see her body, and then the film kind of goes back a few days. And so we get some conversations between her and Brendan, and eventually she says goodbye and she walks away. And the shot almost reminded me of something that we saw at the end of The Third Man, a film that we almost talked about this week, and I think it'll get talked about on this podcast before the series is up. But we see the influences there. And I really also appreciate how Brendan's character is fleshed out. And Levitt could have played this stoically, and he is a stoic character, but in the dialogue and in the facial expressions and in the resolve of his facial expressions, we discover something deeper about him. We see his isolation, we see his pain, and at the same time, we see his pride. He thinks that he can figure this out on his own. He hides his girlfriend's body because he doesn't want the police to interfere. I mean, that takes a lot of pride. And he walks around, and a lot of the shots, you know, his hands are inside this this cream, this tan jacket. And he's gloomy, but he's also resolute. And I think that his performance at the center of this film really works well. And it's amazing too, you know, Johnson didn't just put together a great screenplay and a great film, but he casted some incredible people that went on to do bigger things. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, obviously, like he was around before this. This seems like one of his turns towards more mature work. I know he's done some films before this, but it really does seem like a big turn for him. And then some of the other casts, they're all really great. And all these cast members just chew up their scenes. I mean, every single one of them.
Yeah, this was probably the film that really turned me on to Levitt as a real talent of his generation. I think he's just fantastic in this film, and it really showed just what he could do when he really had a meaty, interesting role to sink his teeth into. Brendan in this film is, you know, he, like you say, he's resolute, he's dogged. You get the sense that there's this vulnerability behind him, that all the tough guy swagger that Johnson puts into the dialogue is not just there because Johnson wants to make a noir pastiche. It's there because it's hiding something, it's masking something. And I think, again, this is where the brilliance of the film really reveals itself, is that it's not just a collection of noir tropes, like, let's just make a noir movie, except it's in high school. Johnson has actually thoughtfully considered, well, why do the characters in noir stories talk this way? What explanation could there be for them to be so seemingly callous towards other characters, why they would affect this air of nonchalance when confronted with depravity of various sorts. And the answer he comes up with is, well, they're trying to shield themselves, shield their vulnerability, mask the fact that they care. And something about putting that sort of persona onto a high school kid who's a little bit more obviously somebody who's not fully grown up yet, somebody who's not really entered into the adult world, that quality coupled with all these hard-boiled tropes kind of makes that reading of noir characters snap into place and suddenly make sense in a way that, it, while it was perhaps always there in classic noir, wasn't really highlighted as strongly as it is in this film. And again, I think that's Ryan Johnson just has a really great talent for zeroing in on those elements that he can foreground and really use as a meaningful element rather than just as window dressing to make him look like a clever director.
Yeah. You know, there's something that we talked about last week with Chinatown is the use of POV shots. It seemed like something a little bit different from the classic Hollywood noirs, and we see greater use of POV there. Something I noticed too about this film are all the cuts, and this is not something that, you know, Johnson invented, but all the cuts between shots. So you have a singular shot of a character performing an action, and we cut forward maybe less than a second, maybe half of a second. And we pause for a second on that shot, and then we cut forward again. And it just kind of emphasizes the fragmentary nature of these characters and of what's going on in their world. I also love the scene at the end where they are in the basement, and we hear this fight happening above them, and it's all off camera. But just hearing it and feeling it move through the scene, we know it's on the way. Man, it's just fantastic. And it, like I mentioned before, it just kind of blows my mind, the maturity of Johnson here with his blocking, with his pans, with his camera movements. There's another great sweet sequence where Joseph Gordon-Levitt is talking to the brain, and they're in the library, and they're kind of in this corner where there's a desk set up, and the scene is filmed through shelves of books, and it's lit naturally, at least it feels natural, with a lamp light, and it makes those scenes pop. And I think if you have the snappy dialogue, you have the noir story, but you don't have the technical qualities to emphasize that, this could just come off in a wrong way. I mean, it could just come off terribly. But all those combinations together produce something great. And then also in the great traditions of the noirs, this is a story that it's kind of hard to follow if you're not paying attention. You do have to pay attention, and even then, it might take two viewings to get the whole thing. And I'm thinking of something like The Big Sleep, even The Maltese Falcon, these stories that are complicated, but that complication is used to further highlight something about this world. So it's kind of all there, and Johnson just kind of takes it to a new level. He makes a step forward.
Yeah, and something that complexity also highlights is and I don't want to keep harping on this, but it really does highlight just the fact that noir characters are in over their heads, right? And that's something that is that's integral to noir as a whole. So it's I'm not saying anything new by pointing that out, but again, by kind of putting that onto high school students, it feels almost as if the weight of all those complications of the violence that they see and all the darkness that Brendan is trying to deal with in getting to the bottom of all this, the weight of that seems like it's too much for a high schooler's shoulders. And that really brings to the fore the sadness, I guess, at the heart of noir, where it's not just sort of enjoying the stylishness and kind of getting a very cynical look at the dark heart of mankind, so to speak. It's there's a deep mournfulness to it that we saw really played up in Chinatown as well, but there's a different quality to it when you see it acted out by what are essentially children. Pity, I guess, is what you get from Brick. You see that these are characters who are, you know, the things they do aren't always admirable, and there are horrible things, but they're also children, and you pity them for being in a world that both encourages them to act in those ways, and also for being in a world that just contains those things and asks them to deal with it as part of growing up.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you watch something like Chinatown, there is this empty feeling you get whenever you finish. It's just kind of a sadness, a depression of the story. Here, there is a more hopeful note in that, and we'll get – this is spoilery, but the individuals who are responsible, justice is served. They're caught. They get what's coming to them. But even within that, there's this darkness. There's that scene where the pen is being beat to death by Tugger. I mean, he's just being beat to death. And Brendan's character is kind of watching him, and he's wandering away, and we can hear the pen screaming for help. He's played great by Luke Haas, who's – we see him crop up in other films. He usually plays a side character, but he's really great here. And he's crying for help, and he's crying for help. And Brendan leaves so he can get away. And technically, you know, you can make a case that people have died because of what this individual has done, and that turns on him. And so now he's the one suffering. But it's still, like you said, it's a lot for a high school student to handle. And at the end of the film, the one chance at maybe a new start, that's dashed to the ground. And so it ends, and the bad people are put away, but at what cost? And it's still really sad. So I mean, it really is a great ending, and I think all the threads come together very, very well.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Well, listeners, that is our review of Rian Johnson's 2006 film Brick. If you've seen this film and have any thoughts on it or on film noir as a whole, if there are any noirs that you've been watching on your own recently, definitely let us know. You can email us or tweet us at the addresses that we've provided earlier in the show. And I guess that's it for this episode. We are getting close to the end of our film noir series, Wade, but that doesn't mean we've got a couple of really great entries to wrap things up, I think.
Yeah, no, a couple of really good ones. I guess we could say, that involve Orson Welles. So we've kind of been moving forward, and now we get back. We go back a little bit, and that's going to be a lot of fun, some good conversations. I'm definitely excited about it. Listeners, thank you for listening to this week's episode. It's brought to you by ChristofPopCulture.com. Make sure to rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden. My co-host is Kevin McLinathan. And until next time, this is Seeing and Believing. We'll see you later.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.